The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is John Carlson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Indie Week. The next hour, I will be reading to you from Indie Week. All right, our first article today. Public details about a reported ICE office in Cary are scarce, but that's not stopping residents from pushing back. A Wired report that ICE is leasing office space near Cocobooth Amphitheater for a growing force of immigration agents and lawyers has prompted community opposition. Cary community members are reacting with anger and alarm to a Wired report that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, is leasing a new office space at 11,000 Regency Parkway near Cocobooth Amphitheater. In mid-February, Wired reported on a trove of 2025 government records outlining ICE's plans to massively increase its presence in most states and major cities through 150 office expansions and new leases. Many of the new offices, reportedly for use by deportation agents and attorneys, are located near schools, hospitals, and community gathering places. ICE already has a field office in Cary at 140 Center West Court. The Regency Parkway location would be its second in town. Indy hasn't been able to independently confirm Wired's reporting that the Regency Parkway lease is for an ICE office. The address appears in the U.S. General Services Administration's inventory of owned and leased properties. The website says the lease took effect in October 2025 and expires in October 2030, but doesn't say which agency is using the space. Indy visited the location, a large office building with multiple tenants, and did not see any signage outside or inside indicating the presence of ICE or any federal agency. An ICE spokesperson wrote in an email to Indy that the agency will not confirm office locations due to a coordinated campaign of violence against its officers, including an 8,000% increase in death threats against them. ICE has been making these claims for months. An NPR data analysis from last fall shows a roughly 25% increase in charges for assault against federal officers year over year, a significant uptick, but nowhere close to ICE's claims. Is it really news that when a federal agency hires more personnel that they need more space? ICE Public Affairs Officer Lindsay Williams wrote, "Thanks to the Big Beautiful Bill, we have an additional 12,000 ICE officers and agents on the ground across the country. That's a 120% increase in our workforce." The Atlantic reported last month that thousands of those newly hired deportation officers have not yet deployed to American cities and may not be ready for months. A separate General Services Administration list of federal contracts indicates that the value of the contract on the 11,000 Regency Parkway property is just over $7.6 million for a 10-year lease with a 5-year minimum. The building's property manager, Foundry Commercial, did not respond to questions from Indy seeking to confirm that ICE is the agency leasing the space. Laura Pei, the founder of the Durham Resistance website, who organized a petition opposing the reported lease, said the expansion of ICE across the country and in Cary is upsetting and frustrating, especially because the details are being obscured. "This is not most likely going to be a detention center, but I don't think that should diminish our alarm or opposition to it," Pei said. "Even if this is OPLA, Office of the Principal Legal Advisor Office, that is still connected to and supporting the guys on the streets with masks. And people being held in secret locations or held without access to lawyers, held without access to medical care." Siembra NC, one of the local immigrants' rights groups leading the effort to track and verify immigration agent sightings in North Carolina, also hasn't been able to confirm the purported new ICE office location. "We have heard the troubling news that ICE may be expanding their presence in Cary, and we've reached out to the property manager ourselves and are still waiting for answers." Emmanuel Gomez Gonzalez, a communications strategist for Siembra, wrote in a statement to Indy, "We encourage local elected officials to inquire into this issue and use their role as a people's representative to get to the bottom of these plans." Cary Mayor Harold Weinbrecht wrote on his blog this week that the town has received dozens of emails about the Regency Park release, but did not confirm ICE's presence there. "We have no authority over the federal government," Weinbrecht wrote. "At this time, the town has not received any request or permit applications from ICE. However, they could proceed there, and we do not have the authority to stop them." Town of Cary spokesperson Carolyn Roman told Indy on Thursday that 45 residents have contacted the town to express their opposition to the reported lease. Roman echoed Weinbrecht's statement that the town has not received any rezoning or development applications for the Regency Parkway property, and that it is important to recognize that federal agencies have independent authority and will operate in ways that do not require local rezoning or municipal approval. Pei, who has been in communication with the Cary Town Council, says she and others want to see the town of Cary issue a statement avowing that ICE is not welcome, since there isn't much we're technically empowered to do that could oppose this. Standing up and speaking out is something that every local government should be doing, but I don't understand why they're hesitant to take that step, Pei said. Pei added, they feel the fear that they're intended to feel, that if they speak up, the people in their community will be further targeted. Congresswoman Valerie Fouché, whose districts include the Regency Parkway address, was also unable to provide information about ICE's presence there. Congress and the public have been kept in the dark about ICE's secretive expansion plans, and the lack of transparency is unacceptable, Fouché said. As a co-sponsor of the Respect for Local Communities Act, I am working to require full public reporting and oversight of ICE's lease and enforcement activities. I firmly oppose this possible expansion. After immigration enforcement agencies carried out a spree of arrests in the Triangle in November, Cary residents organized a recurring protest outside ICE's field office at Center Crest Court on Friday mornings. Community members are also holding other regular anti-ICE protests at major intersections around Cary and the bridge over Interstate 40 near the NC Art Museum, among other locations. Pei's petition had about 1,200 signatures as of Thursday afternoon. She said if printed, it would be about 74 pages long, because almost everyone who signed the petition also left a comment. All of them are just so passionate about how ICE has no business here. ICE endangers my families and my friends. Another protest is planned for Weinbrecht's 2026 State of the Cary address at Town Hall on March 5th at 6 p.m. All right. Next article. What's going on with Durham's zoning code rewrite? A major update to Durham's UDO is on pause after a convenience store operator threatened to sue, citing a zoning restriction that was tucked into an unrelated hurricane relief bill. On Tuesday, the Durham Planning Commission was slated to host the first in a series of public hearings about a total rewrite of the document that regulates development in Durham. But after years of hammering out the new code and dozens of public engagement sessions, the public hearing was canceled by city and county leadership Friday in response to possible legal action taken by a local business owner, delaying the process indefinitely. The planning department began working on an updated Unified Development Ordinance, or UDO, after passing a new comprehensive plan in 2023. Durham has experienced tremendous growth since the previous comprehensive plan was passed in 2005, creating a new land development code, as the UDO rewrite is called, was necessary in bringing Durham's land use laws in line with the new vision of the city's physical environment laid out by the comprehensive plan. But in 2024, Senate Bill 382, headlined by Hurricane Helene relief, included language that stripped local municipalities' ability to downzone, reduce the allowable density or uses for a specific zoning district, without written consent from all property owners in the area. Durham's planning department attempted to create carve-outs for property owners concerned with proposed zoning changes in the new LDC while still complying with the state's provisions. We were always trying to write the ordinance to be in compliance with state law, said Robin Schulze, principal planner with the Durham Planning Department. That's how we have to operate as a municipality, so it was always definitely a conversation. Then on February 13th, the city and county's attorney's offices received a letter from Robin Tatum, a lawyer from Raleigh-based firm Smith Anderson, representing Marvin Lee Barnes, Jr., who serves on the UNC Board of Governors, suggesting that changes in the proposed development code constitute unlawful downzonings under SB 382. Barnes' company, M.M. Fowler, Inc., which owns and operates about 100 Family Fair convenience stores statewide, would suffer significant damages due to a decrease in property value and the loss of development potential, according to the letter. During its February 19th work session, the Durham City Council went into a closed session requested by City Attorney Kim Rayburg to discuss a possible liability claim against the city. The next day, the Durham Planning Department released a statement canceling the scheduled public hearing, citing potential litigation. Unfortunately, property owners have challenged this carve-out approach and threatened litigation within the past week, the statement read. Given the legal challenges raised just days before the hearing, the adoption process for the LDC has been paused to allow time to evaluate these issues and determine the best path forward. For now, the process is in a holding pattern until Durham and other municipalities across North Carolina can gain clarity on whether the current provisions restricting downzoning will be revised or removed. I don't know what local solutions we'll be able to figure out here that are not incredibly messy, Durham City Councilor Nate Baker told the Indy. What I think this is demonstrating to the entire state is that the way that the statutes are currently written, this completely paralyzes local governments across North Carolina. Dozens of the municipalities throughout North Carolina have already submitted legislation to reverse the downzoning limitations, with Democrat and Republican leaders expressing dissatisfaction. Last spring, the state Senate passed a bill revising the downloading ordinance to return flexibility to local municipalities. The state House could pick up the bill as early as April when it returns to session. In lieu of the public hearing that has been planned for Tuesday, Planning Department staff hosted an open house at City Hall, where over 100 residents flooded the lobby, to learn more about what it is that in the LDC draft, how the new zoning districts impact their neighborhoods, and share feedback on the new ordinances. Staff members were peppered throughout the crowd with informational handouts and laptops to walk residents through specific zoning changes that affect their neighborhoods. The tool is also available on the Engage Durham website. Residents can look up their address and see side-by-side the current zoning districts and the proposed new zoning. The UDO process has drawn ire from all sides. Proponents of the rewrite believe that the new code, while not serving the city's affordable housing crisis, could provide a larger menu of housing options to developers by allowing small-scale apartments, accessory dwelling units, and other structures where they were not previously permitted, adding units to Durham's dearth on housing at more affordable prices. Skeptics fear the new code will open the floodgates, allowing development to run amok because the new code would upzone much of Durham, allowing for a larger diversity of building types by right in the particular zoning district. Inter-Neighborhood Council, INC, also sent a letter to the city and county ahead of the public hearing being canceled. The February 12th letter mirrors the one submitted by Barnes and his attorneys, pointing out that the potential violation of state law, though the group is not threatening to sue. Tom Miller, board member with INC representing the Watts Hillendale neighborhood, said it was purely coincidence his friend Barnes sent a letter the next day. INC members have been poring over the 633-page LDC looking for inconsistencies and other potential issues in the code, like access, her emergency vehicles, sending comments and marked up copies of the documents to the planning department. We were really thrilled that this all got halted because we were sure we weren't going to get through the whole thing, said Mimi Kessler, president of INC, who has been leading the working group's efforts to provide feedback on the document. It's just so time-consuming. Baker said the LDC is still a draft, and what changes will likely be made regardless of what happens at the state level. We had another 6 to 8 months before adoption, so there's obviously a lot of time in there to fix any errors and do all the quality control and change things, Baker said. All right, we'll go on to our next article. 70,000 voters must fix their registrations or face hurdles at the polls. Thousands of North Carolinians will have to cast a provisional ballot in the 2026 midterms if they don't update their voter registration information. The message isn't reaching many of those affected. through no fault of their own, more than 70,000 North Carolinians could hit an extra obstacle when trying to cast a ballot in this year's primaries if they don't update their voter registration information to include their driver's license number, the last four digits of their Social Security number, or provide another relevant identification document. Those voters must cast provisional ballots, which are rejected at much higher rates than other methods of voting. The missing information gained national attention during the prolonged 2024 state Supreme Court race, when Republican Court of Appeals Judge Jefferson Griffin challenged tens of thousands of votes cast by people whose voter registrations didn't include their driver's license or Social Security numbers, as required by federal law. A federal judge ruled against Griffin's challenge because it came after ballots were cast, but state election officials ultimately said 103,270 voters needed to repair their registrations before they voted again. State officials, party activists, and voter access groups have spent the last 6 months combing through the list of impacted voters on the State Board of Elections and CSBE Registration Repair Database to encourage them to fill out the paperwork. In the first month, more than 20,000 North Carolinians got off the list, state data shows, but in the 5 months since, fewer than 12,000 people have had their names removed, including just 1,500 since candidate filing ended on December 19th. NCSBE officials say that many letters have been returned as undeliverable, while activists say phone calls have gone unanswered, and the few voters who respond are often confused as to why their registration is suddenly an issue. NCSBE executive Sam Hayes said he thought more people would complete their registrations as the election drew near. I think people will be more motivated to go out and vote, and hopefully they'll understand that they need to correct their registrations prior to that so that their experience at the polling place is as seamless as possible, Hayes said in an interview. Poll workers will give voters on the registration repair list a provisional ballot, which is commonly used by people who forget their identification or show up at the wrong polling place. The ballots count if election officials can determine that the voter was eligible, so long as people on the repair list bring a driver's license, Social Security number, or another compliant document, their provisional ballot should be accepted. They will be able to vote, and we will hopefully validate that information, Hayes said. In 2023, a conservative activist discovered an issue with the state's voter registration form that had been used in Democratic and Republican administrations. The form appeared to make it optional for voters to enter their Social Security number or driver's license number, an apparent violation of the 2002 Help America Vote, HAVA Act, which requires one of those numbers. After learning of the problem, the Democrat-controlled NCSB changed the form, but it didn't require the people with missing information to update their registrations. A state GOP lawsuit over the registrations was rejected because a President Trump-appointed judge said it was filed too close to the election. Griffin's challenge would ultimately lose in court, too. Meanwhile, Republican state lawmakers passed a sweeping new law in 2024 that shifted control of state and county election boards from Democrats to Republicans. When Republicans took control of the NCSBE in 2025, the Trump administration sued, arguing that election officials violated HAVA by allowing thousands of voters to register without the required information. The registration repair project was part of the deal the NCSBE came up with to settle the Trump lawsuit. In the 2024 general election, about 60% of the more than 65,000 provisional ballots cast were rejected. For this year's elections, voters will have 3 days after Election Day to fix problems with their ballots, down from 9 days before the 2024 law. Last fall's municipal elections were the first in which people on the repair list who didn't provide the necessary information had to cast provisional ballots, but it didn't seem to be much of a problem. Of the 1,085 voters on the state's registration repair list who cast provisional ballots in the 2025 municipal elections, all but 17 counted, according to Common Cause North Carolina. The 98.4 provisional ballot acceptance rate among voters on the repair list is far higher than historical provisional ballot acceptance rates. The left-leaning advocacy group said the 17 rejected ballots included 10 black voters, 2 mixed-race individuals, 1 Hispanic person, and 4 white people. Common Cause director Sarah Jones added one caveat. The group couldn't quantify how many voters walked away from voting sites last year rather than going through the provisional ballot process. Jones said his organization has held a number of town halls to encourage activists to help comb through the remaining list of more than 70,000 voters. We are encouraging people to look up themselves and their friends and neighbors, determine whether they are indeed on the list, and be part of a movement that can really reach to their county board of elections, Jones said. Michael Bitzer, a Catawba College political scientist, warned against reading too much into last year's provisional ballot acceptance rate. I would not try to make any correlation between the two election cycles, Bitzer said. That's because odd-year municipal elections have the lowest voter turnout. They tend to bring in some of the most politically engaged people in their communities. So while nearly everyone in the repair group who had to cast a provisional ballot in 2025 may have brought the right documentation, that may not be the case in the 2026 primary and general elections. In a higher turnout election, more people may have their ballots rejected. Many of the more than 71,000 people on the registration repair list as of January 23rd are infrequent voters. Only 2.5% of them voted in the 2022 primary election and 14% in the 2022 general election, according to the data Bitzer provided. While 2026 turnout could be higher due to the higher-profile U.S. Senate race in North Carolina, it will still pale in comparison to the 2024 presidential election cycle, when 4% of those on the registration repair list cast a ballot in the primary, and 31% did so in the general election. Votes for Democratic candidates are potentially more likely to be rejected this year than Republicans. An analysis from Bitzer and Chris Cooper, professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University, found voters on the original registration repair list were overwhelmingly younger and unaffiliated. The average age was less than 39, which is far younger than the statewide voter average of 51. Younger voters tend to lean more to the Democratic side, even when they aren't registered with the party. From the original registration repair list, 63% of voters were unaffiliated. Those who do not identify with a political party are automatically labeled this way. 23% were Democrats and 14% were Republicans. Both political parties are trying to avoid any of their supporters from having their ballots tossed out. Anderson Clayton, chair of the state Democratic Party, said the party's canvassing system flags voters who are on the registration repair list, so volunteers knocking on the doors can offer added support. We're trying to do everything we can to notify people of this, but it is hard to help people understand. You're being singled out of the millions of voters in the state right now to go fix your voter registration. The state party has held 7 events mobilizing supporters to get people off the list. After 4 phone banks and 3 in-person canvassing days in 2025, Democrats had made 80,000 points of contact, according to the state party. This includes leaving voicemails, knocking on doors, or reaching someone by phone or in person. Each form of outreach represents a contact point. Democrats found they were 4 times more likely to get a voter removed from the registration repair list when they made in-person contact. The biggest problem has been not knowing that they're on the list and not understanding why, said Kat Lawson, voter protection director for the NCDP. Most of the voters that we're talking to have been voters for a long time. They've never had any problems before. They have to be persuaded that this is a problem, educated on what it is, and reminded that they've done nothing wrong. Clayton said she hopes for a door-knocking campaign with 150 to 200 field organizers across the state closer to the general election will make a dent in the registration repair list. Matt Mercer, a spokesman for the state Republican Party, said the GOP has also made efforts to remove voters from the list by having volunteers and county organizers look through the database to identify and contact registered Republican voters. We just methodically work through the list, Mercer said. It's also an opportunity for county leadership people to have experience reaching out and contacting folks. Hayes, the NCSPE executive director, said he hopes this is a short-term problem. Hopefully, before the 2028 presidential election, this will be largely behind us. All right, let's go on to our next article. All right, tracking outside spending in the 4th Congressional District primary. The 2022 contest between Representative Valerie Boucher and Nita Elam was the most expensive congressional primary in state history. PAC spending on their 2026 rematch is rivaling that record. Here's a running tab. Political action committees, PACs, from across the country are spending a nauseating amount of money to influence your vote in the Triangle Area Democratic Congressional primary between Valerie Boucher and Nita Elam. These PACs operate separately from the candidates themselves and can spend as much money as they want on the mailers and TV, radio, and digital ads that are smothering the district. And thanks to the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, it's all perfectly legal. The spending by non-candidate-affiliated PACs has dramatically dwarfed the paltry sums spent by the candidates themselves. $354,000 by Elam and $457,000 by Boucher. There's some irony here. Both Elam and Boucher have criticized the current campaign finance system and promised to reform it, but both have benefited from the lack of limits on outside spending. When Boucher and Elam faced off in 2022 for the same seat, outside groups poured just over $3.8 million into the race, according to Open Secrets, with about 90% supporting Boucher, including pro-Israel and pro-crypto groups. It appears this election cycle could exceed that total. So far, ND has identified $3.95 million in total outside spending. We're hedging a bit here in case either total is an undercount. Outside spending can be quite opaque. Most of that has been spent in the last week. And there's a graph here showing about $2.3 million is for Boucher and $1.6 million is for Elam. So who are these PACs and how much are they spending? We dug through their FEC filings and did the math so that you don't have to. Non-candidate spending in NCO4 precinct. The first group is for Elam. That's American Priorities is the largest. Leaders We Deserve is the second one. American Priorities is $887,000. Leaders We Deserve is $276,000. Justice Democrats is $230,000. Working Families Party is $102,000. The Impact Fund, $50,000. Unity and Justice, $37,000. For Boucher, it's Jobs and Democracy PAC, $1.6 million. Article 1, $600,000. And Rolling Sea for $150,000. We previously wrote about American Priorities here. Since then, they've told NBC that they are trying to counter pro-Israel PACs by supporting candidates whose views on foreign policy are plainly reflective of where the Democratic base has moved. That's a pretty clear reference to Boucher's 2022 support from the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, and other related groups. Leaders We Deserve is Gen Z upstart David Hogue's PAC. Hogue has taken interest in this primary as part of his push to remake the Democratic Party from within. What Nita represents here is the opportunity for us to create real change in our party and send a clear message to established Democrats that the days of taking corporate, if you're taking corporate money, your days in power are numbered. Hogue told attendees of Elam campaign event in Durham in December. Boucher has criticized Elam for her backing from this group due to support from billionaire tech investor and gun safety advocate Roy Conway. Similarly to Hogue's group, Justice Democrats is dedicated to electing the next generation of progressive leaders who do not take corporate PAC or corporate lobbyist money. The Working Families Party is a minor political party that often backs far-left Democrats or independent candidates, including in triangle races. The Indian American Impact Fund is a national group that supports progressive Indian and Asian American candidates and has endorsed Elam. The Unity and Justice Fund has some pretty vague priorities, but appears to have previously spent to support Zohran Mamdani's New York campaign. Supporting Fouché, Jobs and Democracy is backed by Anthropic, one of the world's largest AI companies, and has recently become the biggest spender in this race with a series of buys the week before the election. Per our previous reporting, the spending is part of something of an intra-industry civil war between OpenAI and Anthropic, which may be spending on Fouché thanks to her recent appointment as co-chair of the new House Democratic Commission on AI and the Innovation Economy. Jobs and Democracy has also spent to support Representative Alexander Boers in New York, and Anthropic has put at least $20 million towards its political operations. Fouché has previously commented on the spending. Article 1 is raising massive red flags for Llama and her backers, who see it as a way for AI PAC to launder funds to Fouché, who has previously sworn off that funding. It's not exactly AI PAC money, but Article 1 is listed as one of a dozen or so affiliates of Article 1 Victory Fund. Alam's allies have pointed out that the billionaire Robert Granieri has donated $345,000 to Article 1 Victory Fund, and Granieri previously donated $250,000 to pro-Israeli groups like the United Democracy PAC. He has spent to support, well, a lot of candidates, and he also may have helped fund a coup in South Sudan, so go figure. The Rolling Sea Action Fund has upped its support of Fouché recently. The PAC is affiliated with the Congressional Black Caucus. All right. We're about halfway through our broadcast. Let's go on to the next article. How local music lovers keep music discovery fresh. A New Year's resolution to cancel a Spotify subscription and rekindle greater music curiosity, featuring ideas from local artists and curiosity and curators. There are plenty of ethical reasons to dump Spotify. In recent months, a number of artists, Juju, Deerhoof, and Durham's own Sylvanesso, have done just that. Over the years, none of these reasons ever quite motivated me to overcome the tug of convenience and cancel my subscription. Then last month, I realized I wasn't actually even particularly enjoying the streaming service anymore. Spotify Wrapped came and went, with its unsettling promise to be more dynamic, personal, and unmistakably you than ever before. But its annual dopamine hit has dulled to a slight ping. Both the social and discovery aspects seemingly have evaporated into the algorithm. I listen to music a lot, at the gym, the office, on the bus, while walking my dog, or cooking dinner. A byproduct of this is that the practice of listening has become a bit less special, a way to block out the noise of the world rather than to seek out new noise intentionally. Spotify's algorithms haven't helped this musical atrophy. I found myself cycling through the same 50 songs without ever brushing up against anything new. When I search for a playlist, I'm typically served those same songs rearranged in a slightly different order under a title, Millennial Workout Mix, Main Character Energy, that seemed very nearly designed to humiliate. Psychologists have a name for the gratification of computational reinforcement, algorithmic dependence. Algorithmic dependence taste as something to affirm a sense of self, rather than taste as a mutable quality, something to challenge and expand the self. In Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Cost of the Perfect Playlist, journalist Liz Pelley describes how Spotify has begun to stock its most popular playlists with commissioned music by ghost artists, i.e. production companies, a process that cuts costs, phases out working artists, and pushes extractive practices to the fore. This treatment of music as nothing but background sounds, as interchangeable tracks of generic vibe-based playlist fodder, is at the heart of how music has been devalued in the streaming era, writes Pelley. Pair this with Spotify's paltry artist payment model, and it's not hard to feel nihilistic. According to musician advocacy group United Musicians and Allied Workers, Spotify pays musicians roughly 0.004 cents a song, meaning a listener must stream a song 236 times for an artist to earn $1. My most streamed song on Spotify in 2025 was Teeth Marks by S.G. Goodman, which I listened to 63 times. This means I paid S.G. Goodman about 25 cents for all the hours I spent listening to that beautiful song. A far cry from what I would have paid in 2005, squirreling away babysitting money to buy a CD from Barnes & Noble. There are a handful of alternatives to Spotify, all of which vary in the degree to which they reinforce the same issues. Tidal, Apple Music, Deezer, and Napster, among others. This month, I'm experimenting with a free trial of the French platform Qubuz. Qubuz is considerably more artist-friendly than Spotify, with a royalty rate of 0.0187 to 0.022 cents per stream. It provides editorial features like in-depth digital linear notes, artist interviews, and album reviews. On a casual scroll of the discovery page, I encounter Lee Morgan's jazz album Cornbread, 1965, and Wuthering Heights Never's Ambient Replica, 2011. Alongside recommendations for Brazilian funk, trip-hop, blues, and a hefty amount of classical music. There are ways to migrate your playlist from Spotify. That's good. Some, like, say, a certain 46-minute Steely Dan breakup playlist circa 2021, couldn't and shouldn't be spiritually rebuilt from scratch. I'm not an audiophile, and I didn't think I'd notice a difference in quality. But the sound is much crisper than Spotify and goes further towards capturing the magic of live music. Listening to artist Natalie Bergman early this week, there were a few songs that made me feel like I was standing in a dark warehouse, a crackle in the air, reverb glancing off a concrete floor. There are drawbacks. Qubuz's catalog is smaller than Spotify's and its price point is higher. I paid $11.99 per month for Spotify. And after my trial ends, we'll pay $14.99 a month for Qubuz. Audiobooks are not available, so I added another app, the library's Libby app, to my phone's roster. We'll see if I stick with it. My New Year's resolution led to broader questions. How do other people find new music? In an age of infinite discovery, where to begin and how to integrate habits of discovery into daily life? How to retain access to beloved music and still stumble upon a few new favorites. How to keep music habits ethical, local, and asking for a friend. For brains used to solving decision fatigue with mindless streaming. How to keep the resolution to stay off Spotify. To learn more, I emailed a few local music lovers to ask. The results were unanimous. Go to local shows, support local creators, and talk to your friends. The capitalist suture pulling consumer culture together is finally bursting at the seams, so we're uplifting indie artists and each other's. This means paying all artists fairly for their time, their work, and expense. I'm going to skip past that. It's a separate article. All right, I think that one's ended. A little bit short. We'll go to the next one. All right. With QuiltCon and beyond, fiber arts are in the local spotlight. QuiltCon takes place at the Raleigh Convention Center from February 19th to the 22nd. It's just in the past. Related events extend into March. Quilting season has arrived in the Triangle as thousands of textile artists and enthusiasts descend upon the Raleigh Convention Center for QuiltCon, the world's largest modern quilting gathering. The convention is expected to draw up to 25,000 visitors this week between Thursday and Sunday to celebrate the time-honored tradition of patching, piecing, and stitching together layers of fabric with an eye toward experimentation and innovation. And as an aside, this article is from last week, so this is not coming up. As the host city for the annual event, Raleigh is also spotlighting local artists who are keeping quilting traditions alive and taking the art form in a new and exciting direction through contemporary interpretations of the craft. Here's what you can expect to find at QuiltCon and beyond this week. QuiltCon is presented by the Modern Quilt Guide, which formed in 2009 to support artists and creators exploring modern quilt making. According to the guide, the growth and popularity of modern quilting is largely attributed to the cultural shifts in perception, from quilts being viewed as objects of utility to them being appreciated for their artistic elements of design. Bold, colorful, and graphic elements are the design hallmarks of a style known for its contemporary adaptations of traditionalism. QuiltCon featured a juried show where hundreds of modern quilts were evaluated in 10 categories ranging from design to workmanship, all vying for the coveted title of Best Show and a $10,000 prize. In addition to the juried exhibition, QuiltCon had a robust slate of speakers, demos, workshops, and vendors on hand. A special presentation of G's Bend Quilts from the Freedom Quilting Bee Legacy in Alabama paid tribute to African-American quilt makers who have shaped modern quilters today. Duck into the Block Gallery, located in the downtown Raleigh Municipal Building, where exhibition Relevant Material Contemporary Quilting in North Carolina was on display through March 27th. It is on display through March 27th. Curated by Stacy Bloom, Rex Road, the show features the work by three local textile artists, Kimberly Pierce Cartwright, Sydney Lee, and Michelle Wilkie, each of whom demonstrates a unique approach and interpretation of modern quilt design and fabrication. Take a close look at Cartwright's colorful figurative quilts, which explore the narrative elements of quilt design and celebrate African-American culture while honoring the rich tradition of Black Southern quilt making. The gallery is hosting an artist reception on Thursday, February 19th, from 5:30 to 7:30. Okay, moving on. In a new cookbook, Spring Council brings back a lost Chapel Hill. Out this month from Mama Dip's youngest daughter, Southern Roots evocatively documents family recipes alongside memories of a close-knit North Side neighborhood. In Southern Roots, Spring Council offers a bruleed riff on her late mother's corn casserole and writes personal essays in a similar register, comforting with a singed edge. The cookbook / memoir, out from W.W. Norton and Company this month, intersperses homey recipes with stories of Council's upbringing in the 1960s Chapel Hill as the youngest daughter of the legendary Milford Council, a.k.a. Mama Dip, whose namesake restaurant stood on Rosemary Street for half a century before closing last July. As a food writer, Spring Council has chops. She grew up watching her mother cook, not with recipes, but by smell and sight and feel. And that sensory attention carries into her writing. Cornmeal-coated porgies hit a cast-iron skillet with a snap, crackle, and pop. Rock candy gets a good chew to release the sugariness that had soaked into the string. Where the book really finds its footing, though, is in the stories around the food. Page to page, Council's memoir passages sit somewhere between idyllic and unflinching, with a melancholic yearn, sometimes overt, sometimes aching, in the subtext, for places that no longer exist. Namely, Mama Dip's, where Council had worked in various roles ever since the restaurant first opened in 1976. Council's tales from the dining room realistically span the spectrum of service industry life. Just as soon as a tearful customer tells Council that the restaurant's food reminds her of her deceased mother's cooking, another customer, the reason Southern Roots has two chicken and dumpling recipes, screams because her bowl contained flat, rolled dumplings rather than the pillowy drop kind her mother used to make. Steam puffed out of her nostrils and fire came out of her eyes like an angry cartoon character, Council writes of the aggrieved customer. A rolled dumpling triggered outrage. The book also mourns Chapel Hill's North Side neighborhood, the historically Black community where Council grew up, steps from downtown Chapel Hill. Council recalls being able to walk to local shops like Danziger's, a candy store, where she tried her first chocolate turtle, shiny, smooth, and layered with rich, sweet, buttery caramel and crunchy pecan halves. And Colonial Drugstore, where, after desegregation, she could sit at the counter and order an orangeade. In our modern world of Coke freestyle machines, the orangeade Council describes sounds absurdly fresh. The drugstore owner would slice an orange in half, crank it against a hand juicer, and shake the fresh juice with syrup over crushed ice. Beyond lost places, Southern Roots has a way of capturing lost ways of eating. Council grew up with an intimacy to her food sources that has largely vanished, at least for the kind of lower and middle class families who populated Northside. The Council family didn't live on a farm, but that hardly mattered. Neighbors grew gardens, local farmers drove up to the restaurant door with seasonal produce, and kids foraged as a matter of course. Counsel writes about roaming from neighborhood playground into the surrounding woods and the neighbor's yard with scores of other children, picking pecans, plums, persimmons, muscadine grapes, figs, and wild honeysuckle. Northside still exists today, but it's a different place. As counsel writes in the books afterward, most of the families she grew up with have moved on, and the homes have become student rentals owned by landlords who live elsewhere. In an interview from her current home, a condo across town from Northside, counsel said that what makes her proudest about Southern Roots is that it pins down memories that might have otherwise disappeared alongside the places they belong to. The 100 kids that I would have played with on that playground will read my stories and see that they experienced what they experienced has been told on a larger scale. Meet the candidates for Orange County School Board. Six candidates, including three incumbents, are seeking seats on the board as it grapples with budget, enrollment, and staffing challenges facing districts across the state. Six candidates for the Orange County School Board of Elections will compete for four seats, arguing their case for leadership as the district continues to face financial challenges. The district also faces staffing challenges. The candidates agree on a lot, mainly that the district is facing tough budgetary decisions and declining enrollment as families send their kids to private and charter schools. With enrollment numbers tied to funding, most candidates say Orange County Schools, OCS, needs to market itself better to families. The district also faces staffing issues, although they vary on approaches. The candidates acknowledge the need to entice teachers to come and stay with OCS. Last year, the Orange County Commissioners did not fully fund a continuation budget for the district, leaving a $400,000 plus gap in what OCS said would need to continue operations at the same level. The General Assembly has not passed a state budget and likely won't until at least April. Both moves, plus ongoing federal funding uncertainty as the Trump administration all but shutters the U.S. Department of Education, have put financial pressure on the district. These issues are shaping the nonpartisan race for the Orange County School Board, in which three of the six candidates are seeking re-election. The incumbents are current board chair Will Atherton, retired longtime Orange County educator Ann Purcell, and former public school teacher Sarah Smiley. Atherton, who has served two terms, is running on his record of creating a sense of belonging for students and preserving extracurricular activities. He said his biggest challenge he sees are balancing budgets without cutting programs or resources students enjoy and rely on, retaining teachers and staff through the competitive wages, and keeping diverse teachers. He said another area of attention is transparency, transparently working with the community, especially on the $125 million bond voters approved in 2024 for major school construction projects. Though reviewing the efficacy of programs so far, Atherton said the board and OCS superintendent have been able to save $700,000, which has kept the district from cutting jobs. We need to maximize every dollar, prioritize classroom resources, leveraging partnerships with businesses and our nonprofits to help fill the gaps, which we've been able to do, Atherton said. Atherton said the board needs to relentlessly push for fair teacher wages while looking at increasing the local supplement through the county commission. But he said he won't cut programs that are important to students, like art, band, and extracurricular activities that keep kids coming to school. Keeping these programs, along with college preparatory classes, career and technical education courses, drama, Future Farmers of America, and athletics, will help combat enrollment, falling enrollment. Atherton said the district needs to continue recruiting diverse employees and staff so students see people who look like them. Having a stable learning environment and a diverse school allows students to succeed, Atherton said. We're at a very challenging time. Public schools specifically are getting attacked at all levels, and we've got to be steadfast and show that we do have welcoming, inclusive, and safe schools for everyone, Atherton said. And that for our families, teachers, and community, Orange County Schools is the place to grow and shows that public schools work. And it shows when we're all together and supporting each other. Similarly, Purcell said she wants the board to continue working in collaboration with the superintendent and the chief financial officer to look to cut programs not benefiting a majority of students and have money that can be reallocated. But the biggest challenge of the board is facing, in Purcell's eyes, is students enrolling in private and charter schools instead of the districts. To remedy this, she said there needs to be communication with parents about what the district is doing. We need to sell ourselves a little bit better and let parents see the good things we're doing, how students are learning, and what our teachers are doing, Purcell said. Just get it out there. A teacher retention is also on top of mind, she said, though the district has received as much money as we possibly can from the county commission. She said it still isn't enough to raise the supplement for teachers. She said that the board needs to find a way to increase the supplement because Orange County is falling behind nearby districts. But without a state budget, she said their power is limited. Purcell grew up in Hillsborough and has a long line of educators in her family. Her mother and grandmother were elementary school teachers in Hillsborough. Purcell said has served more than 30 years in the district, holding every position that serves students in the county, from teacher assistant to principal, she said. I know the school system. I know each school. I know principals, teachers. I know what the school system means, that it means a lot to people in this district, Purcell said. Education is a great equalizer, and we need to remember that every child needs a good education. That has always been my goal as a teacher and as a principal. Smiley, who previously served as the board's vice chair, is seeking her third term. The former teacher is running her campaign on student equity, well-being, academic excellence, and supporting staff. She said there is a real possibility the district will lose funding over the next few years, which won't leave obvious places to cut because the board has been really careful and efficient in our spending. That's going to be really, really challenging, and the school board in the next few years is probably going to have to deal with something difficult financial choices, Smiley said. With the funding the district does have, Smiley said it will be important to keep it focused on classrooms, schools, and where it will most directly impact student success. But as the enrollment declines, Smiley said the size of the staff will have to adjust accordingly. The reality is, if we have a limited dollars, we just have to figure out how to stretch them as far as we can, Smiley said. To keep enrollment steady, Smiley said the board also needs to share the district's success stories effectively. The messages need to reach families early in the year when they are deciding where to enroll their child in kindergarten to match how charter and private schools are recruiting students, she said. Since the pandemic, Smiley said OCS has had fewer teacher vacancies at the beginning of the school year each year. For roles that are harder to fill, such as secondary career and technical education, math, science, and special education, Smiley said she is interested in exploring an additional supplement. Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools, which lies within Orange County, offers an additional 2% supplement for special education teachers. When school leadership creates a supportive, collaborative culture, teachers study in places like that, and they tell their friends about it, Smiley said. The work that we're doing to develop the leadership of principals and school administrators is another piece of this, to develop their cultural leadership. Smiley said she makes value-centered decisions and is committed to inclusion, equity, and excellence for all students. She added she is naturally curious and does her homework, so her questions keep the board focused on its most important objectives as a school district. Three fresh faces are vying for their first term on the school board. Saro Salvi, a former member of the County Board of Equalization and Review, is running on equitable education and community engagement. Salvi said she's interested in using community support to fill funding shortfall gaps. This could mean more volunteers in classrooms, supporting teachers, or offering community tutoring. Another priority, Salvi said, would be to increase the percentage of students performing at or above grade level. For the 2024-25 school year, the district had 100% of its students meet or exceed growth goals, which compares students' predicted test scores to their actual results. Next, Salvi wants to see improvement with students' grade-level performance. In order to get the kids back onto the public schools, the parents have to trust Orange County school system to educate and be the best choice for their child. And the way to do that is to make sure that everybody's needs are being addressed, making sure that everybody is able to reach their potential within the classroom. Lori Russell, a lawyer, is running on a campaign centered on trust and accountability. Russell said the board needs to continue to work on strengthening trust and transparency through engagement and partnerships to help build confidence in our schools at a time when trust in institutions is really under strain. Rilsa said she thinks OCS should be more proactive in telling its own story as a way to compete with charter and private schools that more families in the district are choosing. Listening to what they need is the most important first step to do things that will improve their day-to-day experience and help to continue those dedicated educators for our children, she said. Russell said. Russell said her legal experience, listening-centered approach, and commitment to transparent leadership differentiates her from other candidates. Brian Edwards, a former detention officer, is focused on mental health and respect for teachers. A cornerstone of his campaign is introducing a teacher's Bill of Rights, which proposed giving teachers the right to have their planning time respected, the right to fair and competitive wages, and the right to be treated as a licensed, trained professional they are. Edwards also said the board needs to find a way to increase teacher supplements. I would say the compensation is probably the biggest factor that makes teachers want to apply for a district or stay, Edwards said. Edwards said one of the district's biggest challenges is operating without a state budget and with the shortfalls in the county budget. He said he would push the board to work closer with the county commission and go line by line through the budget to cut down on programs that aren't helping students so that money can be used for teacher pay. We have run out of time for today's episode of Indie Week. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm John Carlson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Indie Week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service.